Today, how it feels to go through menopause in your 30s. Harriet, tell me what your life was like when you were 30, just before you started to get symptoms.
I was a music journalist. I was going to loads of festivals and gigs, and I was working early shifts, and I'd just fallen in love and got married, and I felt like I was establishing myself.
And what did you think your 30s were going to be like?
I mean, I had no five-year plan. That wasn't really my kind of vibe, but I certainly felt that by mid-30s, I would like to start having children. And you're sort of told throughout your life that you shouldn't get pregnant. So I tried to avoid that until I was established enough and comfortable enough that I could properly look after a baby and myself, really.
Harriet Gibson may not have had a clear plan for the years ahead, but the choice of when she might try to have a child was taken out of her hands when she was diagnosed with early menopause at 31. This change, which most women go through in their early 50s, would not only affect her fertility, but every element of her life and career. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, rage, sweats and sleepless nights, trying to understand what's happening when menopause hits early. Harriet Gibson, you're the deputy editor of The Guide, which is our entertainment magazine, and you've just written an article for The Guardian about your experience of early menopause that I have to say I found brilliant. Can you take me back to 2017? How were you feeling at that time? What was going on in your life?
By 2017, I was very hot a lot. In the night especially, it was kind of disturbing me every hour or so. And I was trying to do a job that I'd been hired to do, which was at The Guide, but my brain wasn't firing on any of the cylinders that I kind of felt it should be. And I was starting to really panic about the fact that somehow my entire universe was sort of crumbling. It was like my soul had been taken away from me or something. All the things that gave me pleasure and enjoyment, sort of my imagination and everything, had just disappeared really rapidly.
What do you mean? Like you'd been dulled somehow?
Yeah, exactly. I was just completely vacant. And I'm a very peaceful person, really. I don't get angry. And I was really shocked by how pumped up I was feeling on a regular basis. And it was an aggression that I'd never encountered before in my life. And I felt like a glimpse of what it must be like to be like on steroids, or just like Piers Morgan, or someone who was really confident. And
you felt like it was like, the early signs of menopause make you feel like what Piers Morgan must feel like every day.
Yeah, just really up for a fight, you know.
I love that.
Yeah, I mean, I remember once walking down, it was my birthday and Mark and I were going for dinner, Mark, my husband, and Mark was like, oh, we should take this entrance to King's Cross, it'll get us to Soho faster. And I was like, no, we shouldn't. And I used that as this massive launch pad to just crumble. And it was in front of colleagues who had never seen me in that way before. And I just remember just shouting at the top of my voice, which is just so stupid. And Mark just took it on the chin because he kind of knew that I was going through something that was bigger than, you know, me. And it was scary and disconcerting.
You now know that what you were experiencing were the symptoms of perimenopause, the time leading up to menopause. But what did you know about menopause growing up?
I had only seen my mum's reaction to it, which was quite mild hot flushes. I remember one Christmas her being a bit flustered. But other than that, I knew that women got angry and hot, and it was the butt of a lot of jokes, like, are you going through the menopause? It was a kind of default joke about women being slightly unhinged. So that was the extent of my knowledge. I didn't know why it happened or what other symptoms you might run across, really.
Yeah, it's weird how we talk so little about this subject, and yet it affects women so profoundly. Clearly, you were experiencing these symptoms at a young age. You've mentioned some of them. What else was happening?
My memory loss was really disconcerting. somewhere like The Guardian, I think a lot of chit chat around the tea point involves sort of sparring about information or just using knowledge about your specialised subject and having references and being a bit sparky. That's really key to being a journalist, I think, especially in meetings and things like that. And I was unable to do that anymore. My colleagues were really sweet and kind, and I'd often start a sentence and then say, I'm really sorry, I can't actually remember why I started speaking. But it was embarrassing, and I can only imagine if you don't have very supportive colleagues how horrific that must be.
Is forgetting immediately what you were about to say a symptom of perimenopause?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's short-term memory loss, but I could...
I have that all the time.
How long have you been having that for? Yeah.
No, really, some time. I actually said to my dad, I think I'm getting early onset Alzheimer's.
Well, yeah, it does feel a bit like that.
And you cried a lot.
I cried so much. And I am a bit sobby, but it was just how irrational it was and how sudden. Part of my job was just proofing some of the review pages and reading and finding out if there's any spelling mistakes or any sentences that sound wrong. And I was just sat at my desk reading this pink review, and I was totally overcome by this wave of utter hopelessness and sadness. And it was a very bleak blanket of depression that hit me. So I very cautiously got up from my desk so no one could see me, and went in the toilet cubicles at The Guardian and just had a huge cry. But obviously everyone's doing a wee and poo in there, so you have to be very quiet. You don't want anyone knocking on the door and asking if you're all right, because you're not really, and you don't know how to say. You don't want to make anyone worried, really, even though it was a bit worrying.
Do you know what other people thought of your symptoms, your behaviour?
Oh, good question. No, not really. For the people who are close to me, I don't think they noticed anything. I was very good at pretending it was okay. I looked so tired and probably malnourished, and I think my family probably noticed that, but I'm always a bit weak in some capacity.
And Harriet, your piece was obviously sad in moments, but absolutely hilarious in other moments, including where you described Googling Malcolm Tucker shouting in order to improve your sex drive. Do you fancy Malcolm Tucker?
I'm nuts for him, yeah. I just don't think, isn't everyone? I mean, when you watch that and you just see him, you're just like, come on, go for it. And everyone's terrified of him. And you're like, oh, maybe I want to be him. Maybe it's that. I mean, you could get quite deep about sexuality and desire here, but maybe I want to get inside Malcolm Tucker rather than him getting inside me. Oh my God.
So look, I should say, because this subject gets discussed so little, that we kind of need to clarify what the word menopause actually means. It's marked by a single day, 1 year since a woman's last period. And all the time before that, when you're getting the symptoms you describe, is the perimenopause. The average age at which women get to menopause is 51. You were obviously 20 years younger than that. What did you think was happening to your body?
I thought that maybe this was just the new me, and that this is maybe what it feels like to be me now, really stupid and unresponsive and angry and sad.
What made you decide to see a GP?
It was all the crying, really. And also it was unpleasant to be alive, I suppose. And then the lack of sleep does send you really mad. And I was really concerned about that in the long term. If I did fall asleep, it wouldn't be for very long because the hot flushes would wake me up. And then I had sleep paralysis, which I never had had before, which is the feeling of often a human being coming into a room and lying on top of me, like a very sinister person. And I'd be trying to get out and this demon would just be lying on top of me until I suddenly was able to regain consciousness. I was at breaking point, really. I had to see somebody.
What was your first appointment like?
It was, I guess, underwhelming. I expected someone to say, this is what's happening to you and let's sort it out. They thought depression might be the issue. So we discussed that and I said, I don't I don't feel like this is right. And I really didn't want to go on antidepressants because I felt like it could be masking something else. And if I went on antidepressants, that might be something that covered it up for a short period. But I might then forget that there's all these other strange things going on and it could get worse. So I left just feeling a bit dissatisfied. And I'm not sure if that's their fault necessarily, but I still have appointments now with GPs and they say, what, you're menopausal? And I think not enough people understand the condition, so they weren't expecting it at all.
So that was just the start. What was the process like from that point?
It was really challenging. We did a lot of urine samples and blood tests and a lot of back and forth. And sometimes you'd just get a phone call from an unknown number and I'd miss it. And it was my one chance that week to speak to the GP and find out what the results were. And then I wouldn't be able to get back in touch with them. They were my lifeline and I wasn't able to get access to them. And I would just feel like a bit of a nuisance as well, because you have to really put yourself out there in order to not give up on it. And getting a diagnosis is probably the hardest bit of the whole thing. You have to keep going and not accept that you are all right to live with these feelings, really. Yeah, it was really frustrating. And Mark had to push me into it a lot because I gave up a lot. And I'm very grateful to him for that.
What happened in the end? Describe the appointment when you finally found out what this actually was and what the consequences of that were.
I had only spoken to male doctors, and I think it's very hard to empathise with a woman on how serious it might be about the menopause. I think they won't understand the impact that will have on you in terms of your identity. And yeah, at this stage, it'd all been blokes, and I was about to head in to see another one. So he sat me down and read out the results. And he said it was really shocking how my follicle stimulating hormone, which shows you how fertile you are as a woman, was incredibly high for someone my age. And he then delivered the news that I had this thing called the premature ovarian insufficiency, otherwise known as the early menopause, which was incredibly shocking. But he was so matter of fact about it. He told me that I wouldn't be able to have children. I had 5% chance of getting pregnant spontaneously. And I said, okay, but that's fine because of IVF. And I'd throughout my life, I just pretended I knew what IVF was and I didn't know. And I wasn't going to research it if I didn't need to. So I was just like, oh, surely that's the solution. And that's what people do. And he said, no, you can't actually do that. And he was really, I don't blame him. He probably was knackered and had seen a million people that week. But I was being handed some really horrific, life-changing news. And he didn't really even twitch.
Dr. Lynn Robinson, you're a gynaecologist at Birmingham Women's Hospital and on the advisory committee of the British Menopause Society. You've been treating women with fertility problems for more than 20 years. We've just heard from Harriet about how she felt when she was diagnosed with early menopause and told that because of that, she had a really, really low chance of getting pregnant. When a patient comes to you with symptoms like hot flushes, mood swings, sleeplessness, and memory loss, what questions do you ask them?
To be honest, if they get any of those symptoms and they're under the age of 50, 51, doing hormone levels about 6 weeks apart can be very helpful in diagnosis. We'd always be offering them HRT unless there's a contraindication to it. And even without the symptoms, you get lots of women with premature ovarian insufficiency that don't have any symptoms, we'd still encourage those women to have HRT.
So that key treatment that you're talking about for early menopause, HRT, is hormone replacement therapy, which does exactly what you would expect. It replaces the hormones that have fallen to lower levels. I know that in the past, there has been some controversy around HRT, but the NHS is very clear now that the benefits heavily outweigh the risks. What are those benefits?
It's really important for cardiovascular protection, really important for bone protection. It helps improve mood, libido, so I'm talking about sex drive, energy, sleep. So there's lots of different ways women can take it. The easiest way is to take a tablet, for women that have migraines or epilepsy or high risk of a blood clot. That's just a collection of things that might make us think that they would need it through the skin. So that will be in the form of a patch or a gel, or there's a new spray that you can spray on their arm, which is very clean, non-messy way of giving estrogen, or implants.
And how common is it for women to be getting these symptoms in their early 30s?
If it's under the age of 40, it's about 1% of women in the UK. You know, it's not very rare, put it that way.
One thing that seems to be the case, and I think this from my life as much as I think it from listening to Harriet, is there is a kind of lack of talk about menopause in society and a diminishing of it sometimes in the way that we do talk about it. Do you think we need to really change the way we think about menopause and how seriously it is taken, both by the medical profession, but also by society more generally?
Oh, absolutely. I think at times it's belittled as being insignificant. So I think what we probably have to get into perspective is that women weren't designed to live very long after the menopause. So we've evolved to change that. But now that we live past that point, we actually then expect ourselves really to function normally. And we're expected to manage all these symptoms along with all the other things we've got to do in life. So I think it has to be taken seriously. And I think as doctors, asking about sex drive or asking about vaginal dryness are things that people don't volunteer, but we probably need to be better at inquiring about. So I think that needs to be discussed more.
So Harriet, after that first appointment with your GP, when you were told you had early menopause, you decided to take HRT. But there was, of course, this other issue. You and your husband, Mark, wanted to try for a baby. You had thought IVF might be possible. The doctor had explained how hard it would be. Tell me what you did when you left that appointment.
It hadn't hit me at all yet. I just needed to speak to someone else. I needed to tell them what had happened so that they could reassure me. So I called my sister immediately. She's always driving her sons to and from school or to football or something like that. So I was very aware that I was on speakerphone delivering some earth-shattering news. So I had to shout very loudly, like, hi, I'm infertile and I'm going through the menopause. I told her that I would need someone else's eggs in order to get pregnant. And she immediately offered. There was no indecision, there was no pause. She just said, you can have mine. And it was great to have an immediate fix for something that I could then take to Mark and say, okay, this has happened, but don't worry because of this. I still didn't really understand what that meant, her giving me her eggs, but I knew that it was a small little glimmer of light to hold on to, really.
So tell me what you guys did next.
We were referred to a hospital and all three of us turned up. We were really excited and, well, they were excited. I was sort of feeling really, really overwhelmed. But I don't know, it was a really a lovely thing to be spending this time with these two people that I loved so much. And they were amazing. But I think a lot of people go armed with so much knowledge. And we just walked in thinking, yeah, they'll just say, this is going to happen in June. We're going to put some eggs in you. Bob's your uncle. There's a baby. Obviously, it's way more complicated than that. And you have to have so many ultrasound scans to see if your womb lining's thick enough. I have to be taking all these drugs to make sure that my body's getting prepared for it. It's just a constant regulation of your body for a year. We kept on being told, you know, should be good in like a month or two. And then it would get set back by something, either waiting lists or something that my body wasn't doing or responding to quickly enough.
What did you actually have to do when the time came?
I remember Libby stayed with us and we all did face masks the night before and ate pizza.
Including Mark?
Yeah, I've got a photo of it. Yeah, we were all really, you know, excited. Libby had to get up really early. She was going in first to get her anaesthetic. And we followed about an hour or so afterwards. Mark had to go off into a room and do some stuff. I won't say any more than that. So his side of things went well. We were really happy. Because sometimes it doesn't go well and things don't happen in that room.
the room with the Malcolm Tucker magazines.
Yeah. But we were in the hospital waiting and we got a call saying she's sort of coming round if you want to go and see her. She'd had her eggs extracted after two weeks of being injected with these really intense hormones. And I remember so vividly walking into the cubicle and she was completely grey and lifeless. And she's one of the most alert and animated people I've ever met. So it was just such a horrific sight. And it was all because of me. And I felt so awful. I felt so awful. Then it was crunch time, really. Then it was waiting to see if these little eggs would fertilise with my husband's sperm, which was very, very tense. The next day when I got a number ringing my phone, I hoped maybe they were just going to say something great, like, it's all going well, just relax. But the news was really bad. They said that none of the eggs had fertilised, so that was it. I had to tell my sister, which was very upsetting. She felt like she'd failed me, which she hadn't.
And what about you and Mark? How did you feel?
We just really didn't want to see anyone with a child. It becomes really horrific to be confronted with your alternative future that you're not living. So it took me a long time to really confront what we'd just done and the fact that it hadn't worked, because it was such a lovely, neat solution to have my sister and me collaborating on this amazing project. But I thought, I just want everyone to leave me alone now. Debbie, who was our brilliant nurse, she sorted us out with a chat to this senior clinician called Dr. Sabatini. And we sat in a room with him and I just felt like he was so safe and so in control. And he said very flippantly, it's just do egg donation. The baby's going to be yours. And Mark was like, great. He was immediately like, this is great, let's do it. But I was kind of horrified that these two men were saying, it's not a big deal, just do it. It felt like very alien and kind of unpleasant, the prospect of it, because it's taking a part of someone else's body that you don't know and putting it inside your own body. And I was in a bad place and that prospect really disgusted me. A few months passed and I thought, I'm just going to have to turn off a bit of my brain that says this is weird. And I just sort of said, let's do it, let's go. And I'm so glad I did.
Coming up, how things have gone for Harriet and Mark.
Mark?
Okie dokes. Hey, baby.
Yes.
Hello. You okay?
Ah.
Really?
So Harriet, you and Mark travelled to Spain for the procedure, this time not with your sister's egg, but an anonymous donor egg being implanted. You got home and it was good news.
Yeah, it worked out. Yeah, we were pregnant with a tiny, tiny little baby who is joining me today.
What's he like?
He is absolutely ridiculous. He's just all made up of circular flesh.
So...
Hello.
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 He's got a gorgeous little sort of a mullet. He sort of looks like a really crusty bartender sometimes. But yeah, he's... I feel like he's definitely like me. I feel like he's got my eyes and we have a similar temperament, and yeah, I don't feel like it's just, yeah, I feel like he's mine, obviously, he's my baby.
And obviously, I'm so happy for you and Mark, but during this whole process, you came across a lot of people, didn't you, who went through IVF, and presumably not all with positive results. What were some of the conversations like along the way?
It was just suddenly realising that there are so many people who are challenged in this way, and you rarely get an opportunity to talk about it unless you sort of reveal that you are too. So, yeah, I had a lot of
really hard chats with people who'd gone through it, like really properly gone through it in ways that were just, you know, admirably hardcore. So it was like a very grounding experience to learn that this might be really hard. And also to know that there were so many other people out there doing it, but it was just secret.
Did having a baby change how you were feeling in terms of the early menopause?
Yeah. So immediately I was like on a different hormone level. So, I mean, pregnancy hormones are their own thing, but it was quite nice. Yeah, it was like a blanket, whereas before it was needles. And that continued until I gave up breastfeeding.
What happened then?
Yeah, it really shocked me how quickly the symptoms began again. But it was the hot flushes. And then I was sort of trying to use my brain in certain ways and it wasn't working. And I had quite a bad panic attack. And I thought, this is all very reminiscent of something that happened before. So it was kind of sad to go back there. And I'm just sort of finding my feet again with it now, really.
Isn't it supposed to stop after a few years?
No, mine will carry on until my 50s.
Oh my goodness. So you've got 20 years of this.
Yeah. And I had a blood test and I'm not, my estrogen is a third of what it's meant to be. So yeah, I've got to really keep check of everything all the time. If I feel weird, it might be for a reason.
Harriet, given everything you know now and everything you've been through, if you could go back 6 years and talk to yourself, or even further, what do you wish you had known?
I wish I knew how to be really direct and get stuff out of appointments. I wish I'd gone in and with my suspicions of the menopause, I wish I'd done a tiny bit of research and gone, I need to ask for a FSH, the follicle stimulating hormone, and an AMH. I wish I'd said, I need these checked. And then if that had got me no results, I wish I'd said, I need to be referred to a gynecologist or an endocrinologist. Instead, I didn't take control and, you know, my life was in someone else's hands. I think women are often used to living with strange symptoms. And I wish I had been a bit quicker to go, maybe life doesn't have to be this struggle, this battle against all these strange feelings you're having. Maybe you can feel good again.
You began by telling us how you imagined your 30s to be. And it's clearly been different. And some of that has been really hard and really negative. But are there positives you can take from this experience?
There are definite positives. It sort of felt like a completely brand new page for me to begin on. I'm definitely less scared of things than I was. I just feel like I've got no time to like muck about being like, oh, maybe I should not write a kiss on the end of that. Maybe, you know, I'm just like, let's get on with life. I hate the word, but it is slightly empowering. I'm kind of in awe of older women who are in their 50s and I just look at them and think, yeah, I respect you. I don't know, there's kind of like a stately cool about menopause, I think. I remember where I cried when I got my period. I was like, this is the end of childhood. And I think the menopause is the start of a new section of my life. Maybe, I don't know, I might come out of this a bigger, better person.
Does that sound arrogant? I don't know.
No, definitely not. Harriet, thank you very much.
Thank you, Anishka.
That was Harriet Gibson and Dr. Lynn Robinson. My thanks to both of them. I mentioned the piece that Harriet has written on this. It is a very powerful piece of writing, incredibly moving, but also very funny. It's called Young, Hot and Bothered. I was a 31-year-old newlywed and then the menopause hit. I'd recommend reading it if you haven't already. You can find it at theguardian.com. Now, thank you to all of you who have voted for us in the British Podcast Awards Listener's Choice category. I can't tell you how happy it makes us, and it's very easy. So if you haven't done it, why not go online right now? It'll take 2 minutes. Go to britishpodcastawards.com/vote. Go on. I know you want to. That is it for today. This episode was produced by Hannah Moore. Sound design was by Sammy L. Enani. The executive producers are Archie Bland and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.